So the last talk of this, let me start. So the last talk of this whole sequence, this is the last talk in the hydrodynamic turbulent sequence. So this is the conclusion. And the talk will be given by Greg Hill, and he will talk about exact statistical hydrodynamics.
And if you've never heard of exact statistical hydrodynamics, it's because I made that for the purpose of this talk. By exact, I mean the use of calculus alone and algebra without further approximations. I specifically do not mean higher Reynolds number, or locally isotropic, or homogeneous case. The only approximations to be used are that the divergence of V is zero, the Navier-Stokes equation, the conservation equation for a scalar, those are all taken as accurate starting equations. The use of such equations to derive statistical equations is a relatively undeveloped field. For instance, Kolmogorov's equation was derived on the basis of local isotropy only in 1997, even though it was first stated in 1941. A lot of these equations will be for higher order structure functions, and they've only been deduced relatively recently as well. I was motivated to do this kind of work by a paper by Eric Lindberg and his finding that Kolmogorov's equation needs an additional term in order to be balanced by data. And that term describes an inhomogeneity in the flow. I thought certainly that that term, as well as all other terms describing inhomogeneity in large-scale coherent structures, could certainly be derived from the Navier-Stokes equation. Statistical inhomogeneity. Yeah. So that's what I mean by it. Calculus and algebra and the given hydrodynamics equations. Uses that I think it can include would be diagnosis of numerical errors in DNS and LEN, because if you have an exact statistical equation, the equation that you are running forward in time, you may have ways of using averaging to determine errors in your numerical procedure. Investigation and evaluation of quantities that are neglected in statistical equations of homogeneous turbulence and of isotropic turbulence. So how do we get from the Navier-Stokes equation to those approximations, and what got neglected along the way? Study of the approach to local homogeneity as Reynolds number increases. How do these identified terms, if you evaluate them with DNS, evaluate them with laboratory data, how do they disappear as Reynolds number increases? And the same for the approach to local isotropy. Other terms quantify local isotropy as well. There's a rather large literature. Antonia has contributed probably the most to it, is a study of the balance of approximate dynamical equations when data is substituted into those equations. And Eric Lindberg has recently also, and in the French group has, examples being Kolmogorov's equation and Yagelin's equation for the scalar. And also to study the approximations required when you use high-pass anemometry of velocities and substitute those to calculate statistics, which are then substituted into the dynamical equations like Kolmogorov's equation. You've thrown away part of the velocity that is in the Navier-Stokes equation.
This applies both to 2D and 3D?
I only think in 3D, but I'll let anyone. So the simplest exact thing to consider is incompressibility. We'll get the simplest results here. And an important conceptual idea is this change of variables. We have two different, I'm just doing two-point statistics. We have two different spatial points. And we'll change variables to the traditional vector separation, which appears ubiquitously in small-scale theory, and the average position. Capital X is the where variable. Dependence on capital X must go away if you have homogeneous turbulence, must not be there if you have homogeneous turbulence. It must decrease in importance and disappear if you're approaching locally homogeneous as Reynolds number increases. And a very useful identity from the change of derivatives from xx prime to are and where variable is this: the derivative of a function of x plus or minus a function of x prime is the derivative with respect to where if the signs reverse. And this is a great labor-saving tool. For instance, the derivative with respect to the spacing vector of the difference of two velocities is the difference is the derivative with respect to where of the sum of the two. That's just calculus. It's no hydrodynamics there. So, for incompressible flow, the divergence is zero, both at x and at x prime. Excuse me, there's supposed to be an x prime on those. And consequently, if we apply this, we find out that we have this exact relationship. So if one averages that, calling D the second order structure function, it has divergence on one index. This is the thing you typically see set equal to zero for locally homogeneous turbulence. Or you see some further refined version of that, like for isotropy, it's a scalar differential equation. Or further refined, in the inertial range, it says that the transverse structure, second order structure function is 4/3 of the longitudinal second order structure function. But here what we have is not zero. We have something that will obviously go to zero if you have homogeneous turbulence. And we have a statistic that depends on the both sum and differences of velocity. What does that mean? That's the kind of statistic you would expect to see prominent if you have large-scale coherent structures in your flow. That would make this kind of thing a large quantity. So the failure of experiments to find incompressibility or the deviations of the homogeneity and isotropy equations from zero is caused by large-scale incoherent structures and inhomogeneity. And this part of the equation can easily be evaluated in a wind tunnel because the inhomogeneity is in the streamwise direction. So we only have a streamwise derivative. We need two measuring points along the axis of the wind tunnel. Since that is streamwise, this is the streamwise difference, and we can choose in the sum either the streamwise or the transverse velocity. Obtain numbers for this side of the equation. Determine why local homogeneity, why local homogeneity is what it is in a given flow. Next complexity is the Navier-Stokes equation, which includes the incompressibility, and writing them both down also at x prime, and changing variables, and defining a whole bunch of statistics. Not statistics, quantities. There's no average. The two-point difference squared, not squared, but two velocities. Pressure gradient difference, velocity difference. It's symmetrized in I and J. Here is a derivative statistic. This will is a third order difference. This one is very interesting. It has one sum of the 2-point velocity. Navier-Stokes equation gives us this. This is not an averaged equation. It's valid at every 2 points and every time that you choose in your fluid. We have derivatives with respect to where, which will disappear for homogeneity. Mostly, I won't go through this more complex equation. I'll just take the trace. And when you take the trace, the energy dissipation rate appears in the equation. So I'll deal with simpler equations just for pedagogical purposes. So I've set the two indices equal and summed 1, 2, 3 on them. The leftover terms that you've never seen before, and neither has anyone else, are right here. They include the Laplacian with respect to where of the trace second order, the Laplacian with respect to where of the sum of the two pressures at the 2 points, and a pressure difference, velocity difference correlation differentiated with respect to where you are in the fluid. This thing would disappear because of local isotropy, but it also disappears because of homogeneity. Oh, excuse me, this is still I have not averaged. Recognize that.
It's not averaged, and we're talking, it is confusing what you were saying.
Yes, it is confusing. Up to here, I have not averaged anything. How does this term come about? It's simply this one here. It's the trace of that term.
No, the next one to the right.
This one?
Yeah.
This one comes from Poisson's equation and pieces of this. You see, this is not energy dissipation rate. When you take the trace of this, you get this energy dissipation rate, and you get a leftover piece that comes that looks like the derivatives in Poisson's equation and gives you this. I'm sorry, this one?
Yeah.
This one comes from this, which is pressure gradient difference, velocity difference. No, because a certain amount of manipulation takes place to go from here to here. I'm skimming over the top of exact statistical hydrodynamics. There are many steps left out, but you can read them if you dare. They're here.
I don't know. Is P pressure? Because, I mean, the units don't look right to me.
P is pressure.
If you compare the last two terms on the right-hand side, P and D have the same units. D is a velocity product, which is not the same units as pressure. Are you absorbing density into pressure?
Yeah. Well,
P is just
huh? P is kinematic pressure. Which makes it simpler for me.
Can you answer my question?
I'm sorry, what was your question?
Well, maybe it's just too simplistic. If you look at the original Navier-Stokes equation, pressure enters over to the first one gradient, and the viscosity was a two gradient. So whenever you combine these two, would one expect to have 10 gradients appearing?
You know the Poisson equation. Del squared P is equal to a product of two velocity derivatives contractually with each other. We have two velocities derivatives contracted with each other, and we have viscosity. And that's how this trip arises. So, excuse me, I'll try to be less confusing. It's easy to see that if this equation is now averaged, every term by term, ends up being inside of an average. A structure function from the double product, third order structure function from that, and so on. Each corresponding term ends up having an average, which is shown here either by a capital letter or angle bracket symbol.
Excuse me, how do you capture the IJ?
Yeah. That's IJ or II?
DII.
Okay. That's the trace of the second order velocity structure function.
Okay.
Yeah. It's the average of this quantity. And so I give a capital D. To serve experimentalists, we must do temporal average of exact equations. And I'll represent the temporal average as an integral over a time, total time T, for every quantity. This could be a finite difference representation of the integral, and therefore sum over data. Everything is the same anyway. But those equations then, unsurprisingly, look like they just did a moment ago with over bars for the temporal average except for the time derivative, if DII is bounded, and if this is a stationary flow, and if you average long enough, the time derivative will disappear, and that is almost all flows that experimentalists care to look at. But experimentalists do something else, which is akin to Reynolds decomposition. They high-pass filter their anemometry data. And you'll notice I got my symbols from the Navier-Stokes equation. So this is the full velocity, not a high-pass version of it. Now, if I do a Reynolds decomposition, which means mean plus fluctuation, substitute everywhere in these equations, I suddenly have a very complicated-looking object. But in fact, I've gone through and done the scale analysis to see what it takes for all those other terms to slowly disappear, so that one is looking then not an exact equation, but the approximate equation that the experimentalists are using because they did high-pass anemometry.
You say disappear, or do you mean ignore?
Neglected. Disappear from the equation, neglected from the formulation. But let me say this. Having looked at all those quantities, I can tell you that they could have evaluated very many of them. There are very many neglected quantities that experimentalists could investigate. And in between, in particular, this fellow right here is the signature of inhomogeneity that Eric Lindborg deduced was very important in balancing his equation for the data that he looked at. His version of Kolmogorov's equation needed a Reynolds decomposition version of that equation. I don't think so. The definition of homogeneity is it doesn't matter where you make your measurement. What you're thinking of is real flows.
Only on turbulent quantities, not on top of the mean quantities. Derivatives on top of the mean quantities can be not good and affect all the squares of the gradient
and the velocity. I think what you're calling homogeneity, I call local homogeneity. Sorry, I understand your point. So you're saying with or without the mean velocity being part of the velocity?
Without the mean, I mean, the fluctuation, the moment,
so for DNS, or I guess for LES, we have to service that with the spatial average because that's often used. And a spatial average I take to be an integral over a certain region of the computation domain. And then that average, you know, with this twiddle, depends on the region and not anymore on exactly where you are in the flow. And that could be a finite, that doesn't have to be a continuous integral, it could be a finite difference representation, so it's really a summation over values at grid points. And Gauss's theorem then looks like this. The spatial average of a divergence by Gauss's theorem is an average over the bounding surface of the outward normal vector of the vector for a divergence. And for no good reason, I try to abbreviate this with a curly bracket notation. Probably a mistake, but. So the spatial average exact equation then looks like this. It's almost the same as you can see. They're all spatial averages. The time derivative does not necessarily go away. It might not be a steady state computation. And here we have the average over the surface of the normal vectors appear in these terms. A special thing happens if a DNS has periodic boundary conditions. Because if we average over the entire three-dimensional period, then these surface integrals are zero, because whatever is fluxing out the top is fluxing in the bottom equally, and likewise from the sides and so on. So averaged over a period in a periodic DNS, those equations collapse to something quite simpler, and so simple that I show the full second order tensor equation as well as the trace. And this is exactly satisfied. The incompressibility condition is exactly satisfied. Even if you did a volume average over a subdomain of the period, this would not be zero. But over the whole period, it happens to vanish. One topic that's been around for quite a while, 1962, is averages over a R-space sphere. This is Obukuo's idea in 1962 that Kolmogorov publicized. Well, this is really the important quantity to look at. So, for small-scale similarity. So let's look at, define, an average over a sphere of radius RS of a given quantity. And now it will depend only on the radius of that sphere, not on the vector separation. And in this notation, Gauss's theorem is going to look like this. So the volume average becomes an orientation average. And the orientation average is simply that. It's the average over the R-sphere surface of the outward normal of the vector. Now you can apply that to that last DNS periodic boundary equation, condition equation, and you get the simplest possible equation that I can show you. This is a scalar equation, depends only on the scalar variable radius of the sphere, and it contains the volume, the ball average of the energy dissipation rate. As far as I know, this is the first time anyone has ever found an exact equation that contains Obukuo's idea that this is a dynamically relevant variable. So these are orientation averages of this vector over the surface of the sphere. This is a vector in F-index, orientation average of its normal out around the sphere. And the boxes are the volume.
I don't understand the term orientation.
Orientation comes from the average of the vector dotted with the normal to the sphere. So if you picture this R-space sphere, we're just adding up the normal component of the vector all over the surface of the sphere. That's as simple as it is.
You have any other orientation vectors that have different angles?
I pointed out in part because the idea brings out a classical notion in an exact dynamical equation that a relevant dynamical parameter is the ball average of the energy dissipation rate. I would divide by RS first before I went to zero. Because this is, as RS goes to zero, this is proportional to RS, and you're talking about the viscous range asymptotic. But if you, in this equation, if you let RS go to zero, you get zero equals zero. But divide by RS and you get something useful. Connection between certain derivatives.
If you say that the sphere can average over the orientation, on the sphere, that means the sphere radius goes to zero, we would expect that typically everything known is not if you have preferential directions.
Not if you have preferential directions. That'd be a good statement for a case of local isotropy in that limit. So I also did, I was interested in exact two-point equations of all orders, because Victor Yakut's work And I've managed to obtain the same equations for isotropic turbulence that he obtained. He used the velocity difference moment generating function. But we can also do exact two-point equations without a smoothing isotropy of all orders. In other words, largely I've been showing you equations that connect the second order structure function to the third order and a few other things. The next equation up will be the third order structure function connected to the fourth order with a pressure statistic, and so on up the hierarchy of these equations. How do you do that? Here's the velocity difference and the pressure gradient difference. We make our change of variables, and we thereby obtain an equation from the Navier-Stokes equation for velocity difference between two points. And here comes that sum of velocities that appears here. And that gives rise to this advective term in Reynolds decomposition that's so important in Eric Lindberg's paper. But all we have to do is multiply by n minus 1 factors of velocity, and we get the two-point arbitrary number of velocities equation from the Navier-Stokes equation. A bracket, parentheses means just that. This is the product of all those things. But here, a curly bracket means that I have to interchange the indices and sum all those terms until the quantity inside is symmetric under interchange of all of its indices. The reason for that is that this is certainly symmetric under interchange of all indices. So this has, let's say, n indices in it. And we can write that pressure gradient difference part differently if you want, pulling out a part that would disappear with homogeneity. And the leftover part is a product of pressure difference, drain rate difference, and velocity differences. So here's the strain rate defined. So clearly, the averaged equation with of order n indices, I only showed you two explicitly before, has this kind of structure, just like the other one did. So under, if we go to homogeneity, we start with that kind of equation, go to homogeneity, then arguably, derivatives with respect to where you are in the fluid have to disappear from this equation. And then quite simply, the equation simplifies a bit. One can go further, and now it's a lot of work to do isotropic or locally isotropic turbulence, because you have to introduce the isotropic formulas for an nth order completely symmetric tensor. But it's been done. So the work is done, and some of the results that I obtained by doing that is, number one, I derived the same equations, as I said, that are obtained by Victor Yaku to use the moment generating functions, the velocity difference for isotropic turbulence. And he and I are very pleased that we were able to use completely different methods and corroborate each other's work. And also, going about this way reveals all the relationships between the non-zero components of an isotropic tensor of arbitrary order. Previously, there was only one known. It was known as the Mugion-Chechikov relationship between two of the fourth order structure functions, velocity structure function components. To illustrate a usage of this, let's just look at the next order structure function equation for locally homogeneous turbulence. It's got to look like that. So I've dropped the inhomogeneous terms. And the pressure gradient difference statistic looks like this. It's three terms because it has to be symmetric under interchange of every pair of indices. And in the viscous part, there's a leftover piece, which was EIJ previously. That is velocity differences with velocity derivatives. In the case of isotropic and locally isotropic turbulence, I'd like to note for the acceleration guys that the mean squared pressure gradient, see here I relapsed to having density in it. The mean squared pressure gradient can be expressed in terms of this statistic as an integral. And so can the two-point pressure gradient correlation be expressed in terms of integrals. This one happens to be for the normal component. I didn't put the longitudinal one up, but you know what it is. So, to continue, there's that equation, and now let's follow for isotropic turbulence essentially what Van Anden has been doing for decades with Kolmogorov's equation. We'll figure out from this tensor equation and isotropy what are the scalar equations that are obeyed, and here they are. So, third order longitudinal structure function, the fourth order. Here is a two longitudinal, two transverse structure function. Here's that pressure gradient difference statistic, and here are the viscous terms. C, using incompressibility, is this variety of derivatives of a third order structure function. Remember in Kolmogorov's equation, this is a derivative of the second order structure function. And this equation then goes over into derivatives of the third order structure function. So there's two independent equation because there's two different components to the third order structure function, although they are related. It's easier to show it this way than to. So how do those equations balance? Let me just show one of them with BNS data from Olish-Borkot. The scaled separation with Kolmogorov microscale. This is the scale of every curve plotted. The top curve is the derivative of the fourth order structure function, and the next curve down is the mixed one, two longitudinal, two transverse. The difference of those two curves, of this one and this one, is this dashed line, which we expect to be approximately the negative of the pressure gradient velocity difference, pressure gradient difference, velocity difference structure function. Indeed, when we calculate the same thing directly from the direct numerical simulation, we get a very close match between those two curves. And for comparison, Olish's DNS is freely decaying, so we have evaluated the time derivative term, and it's very small, but obviously it will be growing as spacing increases. It will be important at large scales. And we've evaluated one of the two viscous terms. Couldn't evaluate the other one, but we know analytically that this viscous term cancels the other one at small scale. And since it's negligible at large scales, we suspect that the viscous terms are negligible in any case. And in any case, the agreement between these two curves tends to corroborate that.
Maybe you can see by way of the reason for this sharp minimum amplitude. Curves that they
have sharp
means
right.
At different scales.
They cross zero.
Yeah, so can you define the reason for it? Is it related to the bottleneck, to the positive spectrum, you know, the spectrum is less speed than Kolmogorov when you approach
I can't say whether it is or not. And most in particular, in the case of this viscous term, I think one would have to compute the other viscous term before one makes any interpretation that's deeper that you see. Well, it looks dramatic because it's a logarithmic scale. It's going to zero, so on a logarithmic scale, it's going to infinity. So I could make it look even more dramatic by simply increasing the number of decades. So
if it's zero, if not
up to D, if you will fit in that.
On a log scale, it looks infinitely narrow. So I've tried to describe what I call exact statistical hydrodynamics, and I do hope it has some uses, but time will tell. That's it.
Are there any questions? So what uses do you have?
I've used it to study the next order equation. I've used it to verify Victor Yakut's calculation. I've used it with Reynolds decomposition to find what terms will be dominant in the equations that the experimentalists have been looking at, and it verifies Eric Lindborg's choice of that one advective inhomogeneity term. I've used it, I think, to correct the direction in which Antonio was heading when he was using his data to put into statistical equations for the conserved path and scalar field. There may be many uses to this that I can't foresee. I hope there are some. But in a way, it's something more of the way other fields of physics approach problems. First, you take your basic equation, and you immediately throw a bunch of assumptions into it. You very carefully devise equations, and you see what terms you have in there, and then you start dropping them off. Much like micrometeorologists have developed the budget equations, the planetary boundary layer for the surface layer. They developed it very fully, and then they look carefully at terms that will go away with homogeneity or are expected to be small and so on. So this is a new way of looking at an old topic.
Is it fair to say this is observational evidence providing a check for the validity of the Navier-Stokes equation? Or is that a simple equation?
Oh, there must be a better way to validate the Navier-Stokes equations than with statistics, I think.
Some of this is not statistics.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it's not a solution. Yeah. In fact, these equations aren't closed. And so they're like a micrometeorologist's budget equation. We try to measure all the terms and see how the equations balance. Except for Victor Yakut, who is courageous enough to go to a high Reynolds number, inertial range limit, and actually close these equations and obtain, for those of you who've seen his talk, quite spectacular results.
In the equations, you said
I didn't present the root to Marbroth's equation, but there's many points where you could stop and head for that approximation, and I did it in here by starting with that equation, the simplest equation I had. I began with this equation and applied assumptions of isotropy and ended up with, in just a few steps, Kolmogorov's equation. Obviously, in structure, this is almost Kolmogorov's equation, except that it has these integrals in it instead of having derivatives. And if you remember the derivation of Kolmogorov's equation, he has a second-order differential equation, which he then integrates once to obtain what we now know as Kolmogorov's equation. So, in effect, I've already done that integral that he did. So this is closer to Kolmogorov's equation than the first step in his derivation toward it. Oh, yeah. I found my mistakes that way.
So is this method, can I all do it compressible?
I don't see why not. If anybody can do it, if I can do it, anybody can do it. I would think it would not be difficult to do it with Boussinesq approximation, for instance. Are those fascinating for rates terms? I studied the ensemble average. It's a mainly a theoretician's trick, and it's very useful for theoretical study. But to connect with data, you need to use either a spatial average or temporal average. With regard to forcing, I didn't show it in any of these equations, but it's quite easy to add a forcing term to these equations. And since the obvious thing is you end up with a correlation of your force with the velocity difference. And then you can show that, for instance, I analyzed the Kolmogorov flow that was used by Baru and Orzat, and their forcing, I could show their forcing was limited to the large scale in their flow, by looking at the scaling in these equations.
Well, if there are no further questions for Rick, thank him again for the very nice talk. Let's thank everybody for being here, and let's see you over at dinner.
Yeah, actually, I need to make a note on dinner.
You want to get an email reminder? A little schematic or something?
Are you going? I suppose I could probably do that. You don't happen to have a scientific workplace? Probably not.
But I never use it.
These are in LaTeX.
Yeah, you can
put it embedded within scientific websites. So
can you get the LaTeX out?
There must be a way.
But another way you can do it, you can make a PDF file out of the product, and then just put the link on the server and in the column on it, or you could go there and pick it up there.
Yeah.
And then you put it on your private web server, or if you want, I can put it on mine if you want to.
You want to go to my computer and show me how to post it?
Yeah.
I have a...
Little LaTeX, right?
I think your workplace is just for LaTeX.
A link would do, right? If you just could make a PDF file, I think that's the easiest. I would just make a PDF file, get around all this hassle.
The scientific workplace has PDF?
If it does, I don't know where it is on the inside.
So you print to a, what is scientific workplace? Is something that runs on the Windows?
Yeah.
Or you should be able to write, all you need is a PDF printer installed. We can make a PDF file.
And here's Paris.
He knows how to do that.
Does this mean that all I
this is why you get the big buck.
Does this mean that all our cameras take a picture of us doing the lecture?
Oh, there it is, right,
sure,
that's the camera.
Well, we can, you know...
Now, this supposedly, I want to try this out.
Big brother, you know?
Have you broadcasted this already for the country? Have you tried it?
No.
That would be very interesting to find out.
Yeah, but that's
what
we're doing.
I'm on this electronic future task force at the American Political Society. And electronic futures task force. And if this works, you know, that could have a big impact. I mean, if this works quick, you know, if that works now.
And what support are you doing? Are you doing something called
Sidecam?
Is that the system?
The camera's right up there, and it's and
all I got from your
it's a better cost. They would be able to in the future they would better
but your talk was a bunch of stills
right
with your voice in the back.
The voice and the slides, and so what they would do is while you're talking you can listen to the talk online. You sit there
in your office at Cornell and
say I want to go to the IT team and listen to this talk.
You have now 5 minutes. Everybody
that's it, I now have to listen to that talk.
So
will it be? But we can't ask questions yet, right?
Questions or not, yes, okay. Call in for questions. That doesn't work yet. Mm-hmm. If I have a question for Rick, you know, say, coming from China or something, right?
Yeah.
Oh, we're tired now.
You could probably open up a chat room, though, or something like that. Yeah, that's another
option. Are
we talking 5 minutes or so? Uh-huh. Where is your... So,
Victor did it quite differently than I. And his objectives are quite different.
He got some ordinary differential equations,
right?
Or 1 plus 1
TV,
right?
Yeah.
The analogy. Have that in your paper, too?
That paper I haven't finished writing yet. Let's see that. Actually, I have Victor's just paper in my office. The analogy of this kind of equation at next order is
next
what
order
Victor gets at all order.
He gets it at all order.
Yeah.
A scalar equation that means that the n
means right, because he's assumed isotropy over
there. Oh, I see.
And so the moment generating function generates this after differentiating it and then differentiating and averaging. So if you can imagine a hierarchy of these equations, where the next one is fourth order and the fifth order and on and on and on. Oh, I've done that too. That was the thing I showed just before I did this illustration. So that's what you get out of it. Now, Victor argues that he can model this term here. Mm-hmm. This has got a pressure gradient difference in it. You want to replace this thing with something that's just a couple of velocity differences. And then, either by luck or sheer genius, probably the latter, he gets this marvelous result out of that. Because then he can then drop that term, solve this for these structure functions. And show how their exponents go as the order of structure function increases.
So he gets a exponent in the structure function.
Because he specializes to the inertia. See, this is not specialized at all.
Right.
It doesn't matter.
How does he specialize?
It doesn't matter what spacing this is. It could be in the energy range that you evaluate this function.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So do you think, I mean, to me it seems like everything is done here, you move the application to 3D, it must be managed to move the flow.
Probably so.
So you could investigate, like, you could drop like the 2D stuff that makes sense here, but you could drop it ahead. I mean, it's like providing diagnostic tools.
Yeah. Or anybody can.
Yeah, right.
It's not particularly difficult.
No, I'm saying you have to.
What's the important thing is the way you organize the equation.
Yeah.
Right? You could take the vector separation in one of the endpoints and you'd have a complete unintelligible mess. And you could go to more points. These are only 2 points equation. 3 points, you know, get back to the scalar problem, like between heat and plate.
Yeah.
You tend to get these sheets of hot air where the derivative is large and large.
Mm-hmm.
So to treat that in an interesting way, you really need 3 points. Because when you just happen to have the 3 points aligned with this geometry and the current structure, mm-hmm. then bingo, big signal, right? Otherwise, false signal.
So how much does this take on your database when you finally store the clock? How many megabytes or whatever?
Oh,
for the clock. Now it does take for the clock.
It's actually... No, we're using compressor on that, so it's quite hard. Thank you.